Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. An uptick in lobbyist money spent trying to influence policy at the Capitol this year. Plus, Republican lawmakers file complaints over Canadian wildfire smoke pouring into the U.S. And there's a new justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court as Susan Crawford pledges to meet the moment. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for August 8th.
I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We have an exciting show ahead of us. We're going to start with some lobbying disclosures. We have some new numbers, and we found that groups have spent $24.4 million trying to influence policy at the Capitol. One thing that's always kind of interesting is seeing which groups are putting their money forward in conjunction with which, you know, proposed legislation. So by far the biggest spender at this point has been DoorDash, $1.4 million spent. We've also seen big numbers from Wisconsin Infrastructure Investment Now, Inc., Wisconsin Hospital Association, Manufacturers and Commerce, and the Wisconsin Realtors Association. So $24.4 million total, and that's an uptick of about 19% compared to this time 2 years ago.
So I'm of a certain age. I grew up watching a show. They have this little skit where they say, one of the things doesn't belong, like the isn't like the others, right? So this one is DoorDash. What I bring that up is the others, like the hospitals, realtors, they're like the usual suspects, WMC. They always spend a lot of money lobbying the Capitol. They're the biggest groups. They're most involved in things. DoorDash, though, was the oddball because it spent like a tenth of that, roughly, in the previous two-year period. We're talking 6 months. It shows you the effort it's putting into a single bill, which basically would allow portable benefits for gig employees. So, like, if you work for DoorDash or Uber, you could get various, you know, retirement benefits, that kind of thing, without being an actual employee. Now, this is going to be interesting because the AFL-CIO, one of the biggest labor groups in Wisconsin, is opposed to legislation, lobbying against it. But here's an example of when a group comes in and pushes hard for something to get it done. The Brewers, for example, they're not a big figure in the Capitol usually, but during the negotiations over taxpayer money for the stadium maintenance, they were the biggest spender for a six-month period. So the groups kind of come and go once in a while. The other ones are kind of mainstays. Like, I'll see WMC, the realtors, the hospitals, the next 6 month period is top five again, but likely not DoorDash.
But and this bill is also interesting because, you know, there seems to have been some consequence of that lobbying, which is that there was some bipartisan sign on. So this is primarily a Republican sort of priority, and the lead author is a Republican, with the argument being that, you know, gig work allows people more flexibility and they can set their own hours and kind of work when they want and for whom that they want, and also not, you know, sign non-competes. You can drive for both Uber and Lyft or whatever. But they also got a couple Democrats who signed on and said, essentially, especially from the Milwaukee area, who said, we represent workers who work in this economy, and better for them to have access to some form of benefits. Of course, other Democrats, you know, signed on to the AFL-CIO argument that workers deserve sort of a baseline standard. But we saw that type of passage. We don't know exactly what kind of action Evers is going to take on it, but we do know that it is officially on his desk, mm-hmm. along with 21 other bills. So as of yesterday, 22 bills have been sent to the governor. This is one of them. We are awaiting to see what his action he's going to take is. The other kind of really significant bill on his desk is about advanced practice registered nurses. So this would essentially allow nurses a little bit more kind of authority in non-hospital settings. And we just got some news a little while ago that he is poised to sign it.
Yeah, so what happens in the course of the calendar for the two-year period is there are three ways for a bill to go to the governor. One, he can call for it. They can, lawmakers can send it to him. Or three, there are triggers, automatic triggers in the course of the calendar that send bills to his desk. So all non-budget bills that had passed legislature since the last trigger went to his desk on Thursday. Here are some of the ones that are there. The APRM one's interesting because Evers has vetoed the same bill basically back-to-back sessions. What's changed, though, is the advocates tweaked some language to make Wisconsin Medical Society happy. So there are worries from the doctors, essentially, of if you allow an APRN to claim to be an anesthesiologist of some sort, that's like title infringement. We don't want any confusion about what you are. You are an advanced practice registered nurse who's completed X number of hours of training and Y number of clinical hours to have this certification, but you're not a doctor. So they wanted that taken care of. So they addressed stuff like that. So it looks like everybody's happy with this bill, and it should be okay. Should be okay. Well, it actually is. The governor signed it. Other ones I've seen in there, there's some Republican bills on crime that the governor's vetoed before, but it's mostly smaller stuff, nothing too like kind of big high profile pending right now for him to sign.
Yeah, that's right. So we will be seeing, and of course he can sign, he can veto, or he can take no action, which is sort of the equivalent of like letting something become law without needing to put his name on it. So we are kind of on veto watch, I think, for a little bit and hoping nothing comes through at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday. And actually, speaking of 4:30 p.m. on a Friday, this time a week ago, we were at the Capitol watching a new Supreme Court justice get her robes. Susan Crawford had her investiture ceremony. And this is really interesting. You know, she gave this kind of, I would say, stated speech. So a poll quote from that: "The questions that come before the court still shape and protect our democracy, our communities, and the rights of everyone who calls Wisconsin home. Proud to take my seat on this court, and I'm ready to meet this moment." So nothing, you know, super sexy or kind of grand pronouncements. And kind of overall, it was very interesting. We come off of the most expensive court race in American history, and we say that over and over, and all this national interest and attention. And then you get to the actual kind of moment that she takes the bench. And it was really quite a quiet affair. It really did not compare to, you know, Protasiewicz 2 years ago when she took the court. You could barely move in the Capitol that day. It really felt like, you know, liberals and Democrats especially saw this as such a historic moment. The Crawford investiture, again, it was a high-profile, a high-stakes race, I should say, the same kind of stakes of liberals trying to maintain the majority. And yet it didn't quite have the same kind of sense of history. But one thing I thought was really interesting was in Crawford's speech, and she spoke a lot about history and kind of the history of the court, so she didn't speak about the politics of the moment and the big political questions that went along with her campaign. She talked about history, so let's look at some video.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court was created when the Wisconsin Constitution was ratified back in 1848. At first, it was not even a separate court. The five circuit court judges, all five of them from around the state, would convene to hear cases as the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And that first court didn't exactly ease into the role. It immediately took on high-stakes, controversial cases that tested the boundaries of their authority under both the U.S. and Wisconsin constitutions. From the beginning, this court has stepped up in the moments that matter most. It has taken seriously its duty to interpret our Constitution and protect the rule of law, even when the issues were politically charged, deeply divisive, or hard to untangle. That's always been the job. And it still is today.
Yeah, so a bit of a history lesson, you know, in her speech. And she kind of alluded to historic cases from the court in which the court established its authority. So I think there was a little bit of sort of coded messaging about this current moment, but again, no specific political interest. So she talked about the Booth case, which is a 19th century case where a Wisconsin man helped a formerly enslaved person escape to Canada. He was taken up on charges under the Fugitive Slave Act, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court kind of used a state's rights argument to argue for why he should have been allowed to do that, and that won. And so that was kind of an example of a time that a state court asserted its authority against an unjust federal government, let's say. And so that seemed quite, you know, pointed, that example. And then she also spoke about the Bashford-Barstow affair, which is a story that I was unfamiliar with, but it seems like a very dramatic moment, again, in the 19th century. There was a governor's race. The incumbent was declared a winner, but his opponent said that there had been fraud. Both of them took the oath of office. Yes. There was a mob at the Capitol, a couple, again, maybe more recent allusions there. But that was really kind of this incident that established the court as an independent authority. And so just, again, very kind of pointed lessons from history, not necessarily naming anyone in the White House in particular, let's say, or naming anything political of the moment, but certainly alluding to it. Just kind of curious what you're kind of expecting from her as a jurist and what people are expecting from her.
Well, during the course of the campaign, of course, she was portrayed as this radical liberal who was going to upend all these things by Republicans, that she's a threat to essentially democracy and all that's good and holy. those are how campaigns work. The reality is, if you talk to people who are close to her, they put her more in the mold of Ann Walsh Bradley, who's a retiring justice. Now, look at the four liberal justices. Jill Karofsky, now the chief justice, is kind of like more, a little more combative at times. Rebecca Dowd, also a little bit more that mold. Janet Protasiewicz, who won in 2023, speaks up now and then, but isn't nearly as vocal as Karofsky and Dowd. Walsh Bradley kind of asked her questions, like, and she did these more like deep dive type questions. They weren't as much combative at times. People kind of think that she'll be more in Crawford, more in that mold. We'll see. I mean, time will tell. Obviously, for conservatives, no matter what style she takes, she represents a fourth liberal majority that is unlikely to rule for them in certain things. What's going to be interesting to watch, though, I know redistricting, abortion, these are big, sexy issues. Crime comes up a lot with this court. You have now four liberals who are all former prosecutors in one shape or another. So it's not quite a clear liberal majority at times on crime issues. So kind of watch how that dynamic plays out going forward. But yeah, this is still a liberal court. We'll see how Crawford kind of, first oral arguments are in October, I believe. Got our calendar last week. Nothing too big in the, to break her in, but we'll see how things go from there. And oh, by the way, now she's on the court, she'll be part of this whole question about redistricting, because we have these kind of cases pending asking the Supreme Court to appoint three judge panels to these two lawsuits about redrawing Wisconsin's congressional map.
It's almost like you know what topic is coming next, JR, because that brings us into a congressional redistricting fight, not here in Wisconsin, but the one that is taking place down in Texas. We have seen a number of Democratic lawmakers leaving the state to try to deny a vote on a redistricting proposal down there. To me, as somebody who was not in the state of Wisconsin during Act 10, this is like bringing up a lot of kind of echoes of the time that Wisconsin Democratic lawmakers left the state to also try to prevent a vote on something that they did not agree with. You pushed back on my on my recognizing a pattern there. So what do you think?
Well, it more harkens back to 2003 in Texas again. So yes, in Wisconsin, we had Democrats who fled the state to try and prevent a vote. That was resolved, though, because the quorum requirement there at the time was for a spending bill. So with Act 10, it had a spending component and a policy component. Republicans, frustrated by them being gone, the Democrats took out the spending piece, dropped the quorum requirement, and passed the policy piece, basically ended the holdout. In Texas, though, in 2003, it's basically a mirror of what happened, but it wasn't driven by the White House. What happened was Texas, a lot of the South, for years, was kind of a Democratic stronghold, right, until they realized, oh, wait, we're Republicans. And so in 2002, I believe it was, Republicans flipped control of both houses, of the Texas legislature, and undertook a redistricting process to try and draw a map. I think the map, I remember in 01, the map, they couldn't agree on a map, and so the court drew it or something like that. So I'm sorry, I'm not a Texas history fanatic or expert, but anyway, in 2003, Democrats fled Texas trying to prevent a quorum. Same kind of thing. The then Governor Perry called a series of special sessions. They finally broke them down and passed the map, which became a majority Republican map after it had been majority Democrats after 02. Again, Texas had flipped politically, but the map hadn't caught up. So now here we go. It's a different dynamic, because I remember the good old days when you drew maps with rulers and, you know, census information and blocks. Now you have computer programs spit out a map in no time. We saw, for example, I think, the last day, Governor Abbott saying, look, if you guys don't come back, Democrats, this map's going to add 5 seats. We're going to add 8 Republican seats. Now, I don't know if that's possible. I'm not a map drawing expert. But it shows you the way that this game has changed, because you can draw districts that are so precise, you can kind of predict what's going to happen down to, like, the ward. Whereas before, years ago, there was a lot of, like, kind of, I won't say educated guesses, but you kind of like, okay, this is likely going to happen, but I can't draw it so succinctly that I can get desired result and get 5 maps in 10 minutes from some computer program. Now we're seeing this domino effect where, okay, Texas is doing it. Indiana, J.D. Vance went there. I went to high school and college in Indiana. He went to Indianapolis and lobbied there to say, hey, you should draw your map. Indiana, Republican state, deep red. It's right now I got 2 Democratic seats, I think 6 or 7 Republican ones. They want to drop that down to maybe 1. Okay, it's possible to do that. Missouri, they've got, I think, 2 Democratic seats. They want to go at least down to 1. Florida, talking about redrawing its map again. California, we're going to push back. Everybody's at war right now. It's all being driven by what's happening in Washington with the coming interim elections. I will tell you this. If Republicans felt good about the environment they see for next fall, this wouldn't be happening. The Trump administration is worried about what past has shown them about midterm elections. How do they prevent that? Now, one, they're hoping the economy is going great. They've got a great message. And they can buck the tradition of part of the White House struggling midterm elections. Short of that, here's your safeguard. Because think about what happened if Democrats win control of the House in 2026 is going to be investigative power for the Trump administration. It's going to be constant hearings about what he's been doing, blocking his policies. Trump learned the lesson from the first term. They didn't have the House after the first part of his term. He lost the power to do lots of things. He wants to avoid that in 2026, last year of his term.
And of course, we have, you know, pending lawsuits about that here. And I am also not an expert in Missouri or Indiana or Texas politics, but I know that in Wisconsin, there are certain time limits that are placed on when maps get overturned, how quickly they need to be sort of put back into place and in relationship to an election day. If that's true in all of these other states, and I imagine that they have similar kind of statutes, we will also just be seeing a lot of this taking place in very rapid succession, just very kind of heated fast fights.
The Elections Commission has said in every redistricting state law I've seen, whatever you do, you do. But we need a map by the end of March because we have deadlines where June 1st nomination papers can be circulated. I know they're due June 1st, I'm sorry. So you count back from that till they go out middle of April. They need maps in place, but you know, where am I running? So that's one of the many impediments here. What I'm watching for too with these other states is federal lawsuits, state lawsuits. Are there any delays that make it impossible to have the maps in place by the fall? We shall see.
We shall see. We saw a letter that was sent out earlier this week from the Secretaries of Administration and Workforce Development to the Joint Finance Committee co-chairs about a setback in modernizing the unemployment system. And so just sort of a reminder, earlier this year, federal funds through ARPA, COVID relief funds that had been used to modernize the unemployment system across the country, they were given to many different states, was rescinded, so unspent money. And so according to this letter, they said, indisputably, the U.S. Department of Labor's termination of the modernization fund set DWD back in terms of completing its modernization project. So again, a not overly fireworks-based letter, but the argument is that something like $675 million taken back by the federal government here in Wisconsin, that has led to kind of slowing down updates to the website, updates to fraud checking services,
yes,
that kind of thing.
So remember in 2020, there was a deluge of unemployment claims filed because of COVID-19. People were told to stay home. They were laid off. The system couldn't handle it. And there's been back and forth about whether it was an outdated system, if they should have known Republicans they were in charge. That aside, there's been a fix being put in place by the Evers administration ever since, modernizing the system, moving to a cloud-based system, trying to improve interfaces, et cetera. Now, the Evers folks took $80 million in COVID-19 funds from the federal government and put it toward this. This other pot of money was separate from that, a different pot of kind of federal funds, and we're getting $27 million for the boost modernization effort. And they laid out what they were going to use it for, some fraud stuff, other things, improve interfaces. Now, the big question is, when's it all going to be done? The Evers folks have indicated they plan to have this wrapped up by December of 26, which is kind of important because those federal funds must be expended by then or you lose them, so obvious target date. But we're waiting for anything new from the Evers administration about, okay, what's this going to mean? When's the system going to be fully operational and live that, God forbid, has another pandemic like that where thousands of people are laid off, we can handle that kind of volume of calls?
And again, you know, this is, I think, a theme that we've been seeing over the last couple of weeks is just like agency by agency, the influence of changes to federal funding at the state level and just kind of seeing how that continues to play out. In this case, this letter was just part of their routine check-in, but we will also, you know, I think, be seeing testimony and like people really kind of advocating at certain agency levels.
Just saw the governor on Thursday sent another letter to the EPA saying, hey, you guys are taking back or opposed to take back this money that we're using for another project, don't do that. Solar projects, like we have these bids going out, like this is going to hurt this project. And Lee Zedlin, the EPA minister, is saying this whole project is a grift. We're going to end this thing and get it knocked out. So there's this constant pushback from Wisconsin, from the Evers administration, to the Trump administration of stop taking our money. And Trump both saying that's not your money and it's not well spent.
That's right. Speaking of Lee Zedlin, actually, there's been, if people haven't noticed, wildfire smoke coming over the border. It's been some very hazy days, especially in northeastern Wisconsin, but also in Madison and Milwaukee. And a number of Republicans have been calling for action, sort of specifically against Canada. And so one of the interesting letters that went out this week was from a state representative, Calvin Callahan. He and a number of other young Republican lawmakers from Iowa, North Dakota, and Minnesota filed a complaint to the EPA and the International Joint Commission, which kind of governs boundary waters and I guess, skies against wildfire smoke. He said, "We owe it to our constituents, especially our kids, seniors, and those with respiratory issues, to fight for clean air. If Canada can't get these wildfires under control, they need to face real consequences. We won't sit back while our air becomes a health hazard." And so they are requesting kind of a comprehensive review of Canadian wildfire prevents and response and mitigation strategies. Perhaps an investigation. At the same time, we've also seen action from Republican Congress people. Tony Weed wrote a letter to the Canadian ambassador saying that forest management seems to be the main driver of this, and so he wants kind of action on that in the future. Tom Tiffany has said that this could be something that needs to be brought into tariff negotiations with Canada, and so this has just been kind of an interesting political moment coupled with this sort of environmental crisis.
No, it's all coming too, as the Trump has obviously been kind of, I say, going to war with Canada, but like at odds with them at the very least. I mean, for much of my career covering politics, Canada was just our friendly neighbor of the North. There wasn't any real tiff there with them, but now it's become this big thing where the president's joked about becoming the 51st state and everything else. So it's kind of like a weird kind of like confluence of factors with them lately.
Yeah, I mean, you know, two summers ago, we saw a similar level of kind of polluted skies. I remember wearing a mask to leave my apartment, not to be inside. But you didn't have this political discussion. And so this has really been quite a forceful response. So we'll see how that plays out. Really interesting. And then our final topic this week, a kind of routine moment out of WEC. They deactivated 192,000 voters through their sort of routine four-year maintenance plan. So essentially, they reach out to all voters who haven't voted in the last 4 years. They send them a postcard, and if they don't respond to the postcard, then they become deactivated. This is part of, again, a routine process. Megan Wolf, the administrator of WEC, described this as ensuring that the voter registration database reflects current eligible voters by deactivating those who have moved, passed away, or have otherwise become inactive. So this is just, it is technically a larger number of voters than in the past, but again, this is just kind of this routine process to try to indicate to voters that, you know, they can trust the voter rolls. We've certainly heard conspiracy theories over the last couple of years about dead voters voting, which is not a thing that happens, and this is a way of kind of getting the rolls up to date.
Well, you know, part of it might be higher is because we had such high turnout in 2020. It's the last election that you voted was 2020, November 2020 election. 3.7 million people was a record at the time. It was topped in 2024. But what's interesting to me is the context of this is happening all while the U.S. Department of Justice is seeking information about Wisconsin's voter rolls, sending threatening letters to the Elections Commission saying, if you don't do this, we're going to withhold future funds. Never mind, they haven't sent any money in those accounts for a while. But I'm watching to see what happens with this request of the voter roll, because WEC has told them, look, here's state law. You can pay your $12,500 and get the rolls like everybody else. That's how it works. I've seen Republicans saying it shouldn't happen with the federal government, but WEC is saying, here's the law. We'll see how that goes. And if there are more threats from the Trump administration in Wisconsin, because obviously he has an extra bit of interest in us because he lost in 2020. Not if you ask him, he thinks he won Wisconsin in 2020. Narrow election once again. So yeah, I think we're going to be in the eye of the storm with this whole thing for a while going forward.
Yeah, and of course, as we kind of talk about every single week, we have a number of high-profile elections coming up. Obviously, the midterms and the governor's race and another high-profile Supreme Court election. And so Wisconsin is just kind of like always in the national spotlight when it comes to our elections. Well, that'll do it for Rewind this week. Thank you so much for coming out. I am Anya Van Wagendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thanks so much.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.